listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now let's set the scene. An eccentric rich guy shakes up the world with a big announcement at a press conference.
I'm just not the hero type, clearly, with this laundry list of character defects, all the mistakes I made, largely public. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark in the original Iron Man movie. That announcement ends the movie and begins one of the biggest pop culture franchises ever, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Spanning a few dozen-ish movies and counting, plus some TV series too, sort of, Marvel superheroes live in a shared universe and a developing plotline that's dominated pop culture, made tons of money, and influenced other creators. And our next guests say the Marvel Cinematic Universe is packed with political messages that reflect the culture of their time and can influence it in turn. They've edited a new book tracing some of those messages. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts about the political and social messages that you've seen in a superhero movie or show or a comic book? Or are you going to superhero stories to get away from all that stuff? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guests are the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Nicholas Carnes is a professor of public policy at Duke University. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And Lily J. Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Rob.
Lily, let's start with you. If we want to learn about our political world, why turn to pop culture?
I've long studied popular culture, and popular culture often reflects back the realities of our lived experiences in so many different kinds of messages and in so many different kinds of presentations and representations. And so while popular culture, be it televisual or cinematic or video games or music, are also forms of entertainment and capitalism. They also talk to us a lot about who we are and what we do.
Okay, Nick, why the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Well, I focus on just the sheer scope of it. I mean, we're up to 30 films, 9 Disney Plus shows. And, you know, films are regularly making close to or more than $1 billion at the box office. So part of the appeal of studying this sort of entertainment franchise is just the sheer number of people watching it and thinking about it. And as a political scientist, that's a site where I really want to know, okay, what are the messages? What are the political messages it's sending?
And Lily, is there something inherent in a superhero story? You talk about this, I think it was in the introduction the two of you wrote to the book, that there are big problems that only amazing individuals can save us from.
Yeah, I mean, superheroes occupy a space that is one that is generally not, quote, democratically, small d, democratically elected. So they operate usually outside of a governmental system, which can be somewhat problematic. And then we look to them to solve problems that we ourselves cannot get ourselves to solve with their superhero capacities. And that perhaps gives us, unfortunately, the out of never being able to solve other problems that we face on the regular basis, because we always want superheroes to solve those problems.
And Nick, looking at the different pieces in your book, the different Marvel movies, if we're going in looking for one political message, we might be in trouble. I mean, there's so much variety here. You and the authors of pieces in your book, it seems like they found a pretty wide variety of messages, sometimes even conflicting with each other.
That's right. And that's why this volume is sort of drawing on more than 30 political scientists' expertise on a wide range of topics, because when you have so many films with so many different creative teams, there's actually a lot of variety, and there's no one sort of single message that I think is coming out of this cinematic franchise. So we really need it. I mean, when Lily and I sort of started working on this project, I think we realized really early on it had to be a big team effort to even, you know, sort of scratch the surface at understanding of, you know, what's going on in this huge amount of cinema and pop culture text.
We're talking to political scientist Nicholas Carnes and Lily Gorin, co-editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see political or social messages coming through? Do you think they're on purpose or accidental? Do you like those messages when you're going to see that big Marvel blockbuster or the TV show? Or if you're reading the comics, the book doesn't go there, but you can. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jake joins us now in Appleton. Jake, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just want to say that I'll argue that I don't believe there's political messaging in this, simply because I don't believe political messaging is a big draw for movie and theater appreciation or just people who enjoy cinema. And I'm sure we could look at older movies like The Wizard of Oz and things like The Lion King and probably find similarities to political messaging, simply because the last 5-6 years has been extremely deep in like exposure, like I more in my lifetime than I remember. So that's my comment on it.
Jake, thanks for the call. And Lily, maybe we're going to these movies for escapism. If there are political messages in there, they just kind of wash over us because we're there for the story of the special effects.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that we're not necessarily talking about a writing team or a directing or producing team that sits down and say, we want to communicate this particular right. message. But messages are communicated. And there are lots of different kinds of messages that are communicated about race, about gender, about sexuality, about power, about governmental structures, about the military. And so, again, it's not necessarily that there is a finely crafted message that is the narrative, but the narrative does communicate a variety of political messages.
Jake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to get into some for instances and check out the chapters each of you contributed to this book. Nick, let's start with yours. You tackled the U.S. government appears a lot in these movies and TV shows. You tackled, are they portrayed positively or negatively? How'd you do that briefly? What did you find?
So one of the things I was interested in when we first started thinking about the MCU and what sort of the subtle political messages might be is when the U.S. government is on screen, is it a good guy or a bad guy, right? So there's this idea that Lily referred to that, you know, superheroes kind of solve the problems that governments can't. It wouldn't be a very interesting movie if, you know, a villain showed up and, you know, Congress passed a law and solved it. That might not be what people are looking for when they want to go see a blockbuster. So then the question is, well, okay, so what is government's function in here? Is it sort of a hapless, you know, we can't do anything and the heroes come and save us? Is it potentially an adversary? Is it corrupt? Is it, you know, working against the heroes? And so I worked with a couple of research assistants to actually code every single instance when the U.S. government is represented on screen in all the MCU films in phases 1 through 3, so the first 23, 24 films. And what we found is actually more often than not, government is on the side of the good guys. It's not helpless. It's not evil. More often than not, government is there and working with the heroes. So that's what we mean when we talk about the sort of subtle political messages that we find in these, you know, there's never sort of a scene where, you know, a hero is saying, oh, government is good or government is bad. But in the background, we're seeing government operate. And I wanted to know, you know, what's the message people are taking away?
And then, Lily, you looked at the role of nostalgia in the Marvel Cinematic Universe versus, you know, the way it's used in the political world now. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, I was looking at the way that movies themselves are entities that are structured nostalgically. Your experience going to the movie often takes you to a different place that can make you yearn for a different time or experience. And so I was looking at the MCU broadly in terms of what is being presented in this way that would make somebody yearn for another time or a different construction of our current situation. And I found that there is a connection between both nationalism, particularly U.S. nationalism, and a kind of nostalgic yearning for heroics from times gone by. And, you know, Captain America is kind of obviously an embodiment of this because his life spans 100 years or more. But you also see this in some of the other franchises, like in WandaVision, where nostalgic sort of tempos are integrated into the entire series by presenting it as different sort of decades of sitcoms. And so you have a lot of woven into the MCU, a structural nostalgia. And I wanted to sort of think about that and understand that in terms of this whole cinematic universe. Is it just Captain America, or is there more than Captain America in terms of that sort of understanding?
We're talking about big screen superheroes and some of the political and social messages they may send with the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about political messages, social messages that might show up in superhero pop culture, whether it's on the big screen or small screen or the small page? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lily Gorin and Nicholas Carnes, political scientist and editors of the new book called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you followed some or all of these movies and TV shows in that Marvel world? Do you see political themes and messages in any superhero stories, print or screen? Do you like those messages? Do they bother you? A little of both sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Waupun. Michael, hi.
Hi. Enjoying the conversation here. Many years ago, I was able to meet Stan Lee at a comic book convention. I brought my Silver Surfer comic, and he paused, and he looked at it, and he said, "Ah, Silver Surfer, he was always my favorite." And as a little fanboy, as a kid, that just made my day, that like my favorite character was Stan Lee's favorite character.
What is it about Silver Surfer that you and maybe Stan Lee appreciated?
Well, he's a character that sacrificed himself in order to save the planet Earth from the character Galactus, and then he became kind of a herald for him, just kind of searching the universe, looking for planets for him to devour. And it kind of expresses our own humanity and our own, maybe, you know, Galactus couldn't understand why he would do that.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Lily, this is kind of contrary to my point I brought up earlier. We're waiting for the superhero to save us. This is a case, this is a character who hasn't appeared in the Marvel Cinematic Universe yet, I don't think. But a normal person who sacrifices himself with a huge ethical decision. Do you see in some ways superheroes being an inspiration for individual action in the political or social world?
Oh, I would say so. And of course, you do have a number of the MCU superheroes who are not, in fact, gifted with superpowers. Both Iron Man and also Black Widow are straight up human beings. They don't have special powers. And of course, Iron Man is a man in a can. And so he designed it and it does all kinds of stuff. But he is, you know, he is just a human being like the rest of us. And so I do think that there is a dimension, particularly of this understanding of what a hero is and who a hero is. And a couple of our authors really dig at that and sort of put it in context of, you know, how we might each be able to be heroes in particular ways. And what is it that makes a hero? Superheroes have these particular qualities and capacities. But the idea of a hero has much longer legs in a lot of ways.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hope you still have that autograph. That's pretty cool. Nick, we've talked a lot about, I think, U.S. politics and your work looks at the U.S. government in the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. But and the two of you write about this in your introduction. These are movies where people are hoping to make money all over the world that can lead to some compromises. A location, for example, I think a Doctor Strange movie gets changed from Tibet to Nepal to not offend the Chinese government. How much does the global audience, you think, affect the messages, the choices we see?
Well, I just want to say first, I still have goosebumps from Michael's description of his interaction with Stan Lee.
Yeah,
I'm
cool.
A comic book fan myself and a fan of the genre. So I'm still reeling from that anecdote. I think that's a great example. Moving Kamar-Taj, Doctor Strange's sort of trainings, where Doctor Strange is trained, moving that from Tibet, which it is in the comics, to Nepal, which it is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is a great example of Marvel Studios and Disney really trying to avoid political controversy. And, you know, our first caller said, you know, I don't see a lot of political messaging in here. I actually think that's not an accident. You know, Disney's trying to appeal to global audiences and to a broad audience here in the U.S., and so they're really trying to stay out of political fights. They you know, sometimes can't help themselves. You know, fans will pressure for, you know, Disney or Marvel Studios for more representation or for less representation. You know, they're going to be accused of being too woke or not progressive or not enough. And I think in this, you know, the sort of capitalist or the sort of market impulse that's driving, you know, a big corporation like Disney is always going to be avoid those controversies when you can. So I think you're going to see that not just internationally, but also in terms of the way they interact with domestic political debates.
Talking to Nick Carnes and Lily Gorin about the new book. They're co-editors of The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily, Nick just mentioned issues of representation. That occupies a good chunk of this book, different essays on how representation has changed over the years in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Can you talk about some of the things that the authors bring up?
Yeah, this is a really rich area of discussion in the book. All areas are excellent, but there were just a lot of different contributors who wanted to talk about different aspects of this question of representation. So there's questions of feminism that are explored in a number of places. There's questions of disability and trauma that is explored. There's this really fascinating chapter on how the Avengers are a kind of found family or built family. That was a really fascinating chapter when it first came across our desks and we started reading it. There are, of course, questions about masculinity, because that's so much of what is presented in symbolic ways throughout the MCU. There is a question of the MCU closet and who's still in it and sort of lack of representation in certain regards with regard to the LGBTQ plus community. So all of these different areas are sort of represented in different chapters. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion with regard to race and understanding a place like Wakanda, which is a kind of Afro-futurist paradise, if you will. And, you know, how that sort of stacks up against our understanding of the Black lived experience. So there's all kinds of stuff in there in terms of these many, many, many properties and, you know, what they are communicating in terms of character development and narrative and symbols and our understanding of ourselves.
Nick, as a comics fan and a political scientist, I imagine you must bring this into the classroom sometimes. How do you talk to your students about how to read a text like a superhero movie and start to look for these kind of messages?
Well, so I sort of take a lot of cues from the, you know, scholars like Lily who, you know, really have deep expertise on popular culture. I try to convey to students something that I learned from Lily, actually, which is, to think about politics not just as elections, campaigns, debates, speeches, but to see politics as, you know, questions about power, representation, and how we live our lives. And once you sort of take that broader perspective on politics, you start to better, you know, see the politics that does exist in popular culture texts like the MCU. And you also better understand why people so often have real world political debates about what occurs in fictional, you know, storytelling. You know, why people will say, I don't like this character being depicted this way. It's because that's really a site where politics is happening, even in fiction, even in superhero stories. So I try to convey that to my students.
Just a few moments left. I'm going to put each of you on the spot and ask for a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie recommendation if somebody's going to see just one. Lily, you get to go first.
Thor Ragnarok.
Okay, easy. Quick line on why.
Because it's hysterically funny, and it really is an interesting exploration of, you know, sort of superheroics. And there are a variety of different sort of nods towards gender and race as well.
And Nick?
I'd have to go with Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 1 or 2.
Excellent. That is all the time we have. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, thanks again.
Been talking to Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University, and Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. They're the co-editors of the book we've been talking about. It's called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They both had a quick pick. I like that. No hemming and hawing. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, we've talked over the years a lot about addiction and substance abuse here on the show. Our next guest says we can learn a lot from addiction treatment about a related problem in our lives, compulsive overconsumption. That could be anything from compulsive shopping, a computer game habit, constantly checking our social media and our phones. What ties all those together? The system of pain and pleasure in our brains and dopamine in particular. We're taking a look now at dopamine and its role in a wide variety of problems, from substance abuse disorders to compulsively checking our phones. In her new book, our next guest says that modern excess has made us all the more vulnerable to addiction and to compulsive behaviors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these, or have you had one of these experiences, a compulsive behavior? Binge watching shows past the point where it feels healthy, constantly checking social media, eating, you name it. How do they make you feel? Did you find a way to cut down on them? Do you have questions about how all this works in our lives and in our brains? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Anna Lemke is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. She's the author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We, as I mentioned, we talk a lot about addiction and substance abuse disorder. I'd like, if you would, for you to introduce this concept of compulsive overconsumption. It's got overlap with what we think of as addiction, but it might involve a lot of activities that we might not think of as addictive. What do we mean by that?
Well, addiction is a spectrum disorder, and it is possible to be a little bit addicted, which means that we engage in behaviors in a compulsive, out of control way that is ultimately not in line with our goals and values, and may even be harming us and other people. And this can apply not just to things that we put in our bodies, including food, but can also apply to behaviors, things like gambling, shopping, pornography, masturbation, video games, social media, cryptocurrency, online chess, you name it. I have probably heard of pretty much every compulsive overconsumption slash addiction type behavior you could imagine. Why? Because we all have the same ancient machinery that has us reflexively approaching pleasure and avoiding pain. It's called the pleasure-pain balance, or at least that's what I call it. And it's wonderfully adapted to a world of scarcity, but not so much for a world of overwhelming overabundance, which is the world we live in now.
Let's open up the hood on that machinery and one of the key ingredients in the title of your book, dopamine. What is it? Why is it such a big part of this story?
Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical that we make in our brain. It's fundamental to the experience of pleasure, reward, and motivation. It's also important for movement. That's no coincidence. Most organisms have to move to get the reward they want. But humans have been able to engineer our ecosystem so that we can just sit on the couch, swipe right and swipe left, and get our heart's desire. And this is very problematic for the brain, because what happens is that now we're releasing huge amounts of dopamine in the reward pathway very quickly. And that is not what our brains evolve for. And the result is that we're all becoming vulnerable to the problem of addiction, because what our brains do in the presence of these sudden intense spikes of dopamine is that our brains adapt by, in fact, downregulating our own dopamine production and transmission, not just to baseline tonic levels of dopamine firing, but actually below baseline to a dopamine deficit state. That's the come down, the hangover, the after effect. And with repeated exposure to high amounts of dopamine, a fire hose of dopamine, if you will, what essentially happens is we end up in a chronic or long-term dopamine deficit state, which is akin to a clinical depression. And I think that is the reason, or at least part of the reason, why we're seeing increasing rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide all over the world, but especially in rich nations. Of course, trauma, socioeconomic disparity, and many other stressors play a role, but I contend that it is the stress of overwhelming overabundance and the drugification of modern life that is in fact driving our brains to be in a physiologic dopamine deficit state, which feels exactly like depression.
I want to hammer that home a little bit. Let's say I like something like I do computer games. I mostly play them in a healthy way. At points in my life, I've definitely played them too much. That first bit of playing feels nice. I probably get a little bit of that dopamine. But if I keep doing it again and again and again, I can speak from experience. It gets less fun over time. I feel worse about it. That same amount of time spent playing isn't as fun. That's what's going on with that dopamine cycle, in effect?
Exactly. So exposure to highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors over time will, in fact, change our brain and reset our hedonic or joy set point, such that our pleasure-pain balance becomes chronically tilted to the side of pain. And now we need more and more pleasure, not to feel good, but just to feel normal. And when we're not engaging in our intoxicant, we are in a depressed state, a dopamine deficit state, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving.
Talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the book Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke is an expert on addiction, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you willing to share your experience with this kind of compulsive habit, behavior, whatever you want to call it? Is that something you have now, maybe with social media, shopping, a substance, the list goes on and on? Did you find a way to break out of it? Love to hear it. If you did, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, it seems like a challenge here when we're talking about something that, you know, isn't a known dangerous drug, a heroin or something like that. How do we know when we've crossed the line from, hey, this is a thing I like to do and have fun doing, to this is a compulsive overconsumption of this thing?
You need to look for the three C's: control, compulsion, and consequences. So out of control use means using more than we planned or intended to, or more than is consistent with our goals and values, including opportunity costs. So what are the things we're not doing because we're spending so much time doing a particular behavior or a particular drug? Compulsion refers to a lot of our mental real estate now being occupied by thinking about our drug to the exclusion of other things, as well as a level of automaticity around initiating our drug use. And again, I use the term drug very broadly to incorporate behaviors as well. And then most importantly, we want to look for consequences. These can be relationship consequences, work consequences, health consequences, especially continued consequences, continued use despite consequences. So those are the signs that we look for as people are tipping from recreational or even self-medication kind of use into overuse, compulsive use, and addictive use. Other soft signs to look for are when we start to lead the double life or lie about our consumption to other people. This is very classically happens as people become addicted. They tend to lead this double life where they're not even being honest with themselves about what they're using and how they're spending their time. The other soft sign to look for is to think about and be very mindful of not just how we feel when we're doing our drug, but how we feel afterward. So to take your example of the video games, you can certainly remember the kind of pleasure you initially felt when you were playing video games, but now think about how you felt as you were trying to stop or right after you stopped. That brings into awareness this kind of dopamine free fall that happens when we stop using a highly intoxicating substance or drug.
We're talking to Dr. Anna Lemke about her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these experiences, are these ideas sounding familiar to you, something you're dealing with now or went through earlier in your life? How did you get through it? Did you find ways to change habits, separate yourself from whatever it is that might have triggered this compulsive overconsumption of, you fill in the blank of what? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Anna Lemke, author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Gary is with us in southern Wisconsin. Gary, hello.
Hi there. I have come in an unusual story. I had a tremendous amount of tragedy when I was younger, about 21 years old. My sister was killed in a car accident. I was in the car accident, didn't walk for 2 years, had 14 surgeries. My dad later, a year after that, committed suicide. I was so depressed, I went to a doctor. They misdiagnosed me as schizophrenic and put me on Stelazine. Now, anybody that researches Stelazine knows that it down-regulates dopamine dramatically. And since that period, I've always had trouble with depression. Mm-hmm. So after many, many years, I've now had over 20 surgeries. And, you know, I try to do what I can to lift my mood. But because of that Stelazine damage to my brain, I always have trouble. I take like L-tyrosine, L-phenylalanine, that type of thing. But I still have PTSD and tremendous pain all the time.
Gary, I'm so sorry you went through all of that, and best to you. Dr. Lemke, obviously we can't diagnose Gary here, but that idea of medications that suppress dopamine, it seems like that would be something we'd want to be really careful with.
Well, it's an interesting call. And yeah, Gary, gosh, I would think what jumps out at me is your incredible resilience at enduring so much life tragedy and coming through the other side. You know, stelazine is a dopamine receptor antagonist. It's used to treat psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. I'm not aware of any research showing that it leaves a long-lasting dopamine deficit state. You know, it's possible, I suppose, but really typically once people stop taking a medication like stelazine, it will no longer be blocking those dopamine receptors and shouldn't really leave any long-term residual damage. So, you know, it's hard to know, Gary, whether it's the medicine or whether it's your life tragedies that set you up for depression or whether, you know, there are all the surgeries. I mean, there are so many reasons why, you know, your life has been harder. But it's an interesting point and it's an interesting question, the ways that chemicals that limit dopamine might have some long-lasting effect. Although, again, I'm not aware of any research showing that.
Gary, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Martin joins us now in Duluth. Martin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Martin?
Well, the question of rewarding yourself for breaking a bad habit and whether there's what kind of merit or not merit there is to that. Years ago, when I quit smoking cigarettes, I rewarded myself with buying a lot of expensive camping gear. And I'm assuming that's probably not a bad idea. I just want to hear her comments.
Interesting, Martin. That idea, Dr. Lebke, of replacing that habit we don't want, that addiction, with something better. What do you think?
Right. So there have been a lot of popular books written about doing just what you did, Martin, when trying to give up a bad habit, replace the one reward with another reward, as you did with the buying camping gear. The problem with that is twofold. First of all, there's the risk of cross addiction, where you could get addicted potentially to shopping. It sounds like you didn't, or at least you didn't elaborate on that. So that's good news. But the other problem with replacing one reward with another is that we're merely just continuing to prime our dopamine reward pathway. Whereas the intervention that I recommend in the book is to actually simply abstain from the highly reinforcing drug or behavior for long enough to reset reward pathways and let dopamine firing come back up to normal baseline levels. Now, obviously, that's easier said than done, but that is the recommendation that I have, as opposed to this idea of replacing rewards, which doesn't quite reset reward pathways. And may lead to a new addiction.
Thanks for calling in, Martin, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, I want to stay with strategies to help get out of these addictions. You talk about this idea in the book of self-binding, not just counting on willpower, which I know wouldn't work for me, but framing our lives, separating ourselves from the temptation. What kind of things are you talking about?
So this is using literal and metacognitive barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice so that we can press the pause button between desire and consumption. So for example, with a video game addiction, this would mean eliminating all of the video games from our various devices. Maybe if we have some kind of game console, putting that away for the 4-week period of the dopamine fast, long enough to reset reward pathways so that we can really then engage our willpower more successfully and not exhaustively. With a food addiction, this would involve getting that food of choice out of the house and only keeping the kind of healthier foods that we're wanting to eat. With a more typical cannabis or alcohol or other drug use disorder, this would mean, getting that drug out of the house and also generally avoiding people, places, and things that might trigger us to use our drug. What's really interesting about triggers is that they also release dopamine, and we get a little bit high just thinking about or being reminded of our drug of choice, followed by a little mini dopamine deficit state, which is the state of craving, which then motivates us to use. So part of overcoming any kind of addiction means not just insulating ourselves from the actual drug, but also insulating ourselves to the extent possible from reminders or triggers of the drug.
We are talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, addiction expert, author of the book Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. We heard on Twitter from Leah, who writes, tanning was my addiction through high school and college, using tanning beds. Leah says, I love the quick dopamine and results it would provide. I've since stopped tanning and have accepted my natural skin tone, and I'm healthier for it, she writes. That idea of accepting life without whatever addiction is, Dr. Lemke, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks, Leah. I love that you brought this up because it really does speak to the ways in which we can get addicted to many different types of reinforcers. And in the case of tanning beds, it's not just the look that probably was reinforcing or potentially addictive, but probably it was the physiologic response you got from the tanning itself. So the chemical boost, the little dopamine hit you got from the tanning. So yeah, I think, you know, a big part of recovery from any addiction or compulsive overconsumption is readjusting ourselves to a life that's not full of these highs and lows, but somewhere in between. A patient of mine who had a very severe opioid addiction and who got into recovery and was grateful for his recovery, but missed some of the drama and excitement of his addicted life, actually turned toward tabletop games where he could assume certain characters and engage in excitement through the drama of the tabletop game rather than in his real life, which was more drama than he needed or wanted. Sometimes we encourage patients to do sort of secretly radical things to allow them to adjust to the sometimes boring, nature of everyday life. And this can be things like just wearing really exciting underwear or something like that.
Time for one more caller. Laura is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Laura, hi.
Yes, hi. I was calling to find out if this dopamine situation might have any relationship to a person who is a hoarder, where in that in the acquisition of the items that they tend to hoard, that there's the satisfaction, there's, you know, a high that they kind of get out of it.
Laura, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left, but Dr. Lemke, I'm guessing the answer is yes, dopamine could be part of that acquiring and keeping stuff, hoarding.
Oh, most certainly. So that cycle of acquisition and the anticipation and pleasure we get from collecting things and keeping things definitely involves dopamine. In the book, I talk about a patient who got addicted to buying things on Amazon, went into thousands of dollars in debt, had rooms full of keychains, sunglasses, and mugs he didn't need. And for him, it was really the process of acquisition, choosing the item, waiting for it to come. The moment he opened it and got it, he went into a severe dopamine deficit state withdrawal and then was back on the computer again looking for the next thing.
Thanks for that call, Laura. In our last minute or so, Dr. Lemke, part of the point in your book is it's really easy for us to find the things that make us feel good and then they stop making us feel good. You suggest we lean into the rest of life, the parts that don't always feel so good. How can we do that?
Well, what we've found is that by pressing on the pain side of the balance, which is to say doing things intentionally that are difficult, like exercise, ice cold water plunges, or anything that requires iterative endurance, attention, and effort, is a way to get dopamine indirectly. Because what we're doing when we expose ourselves to mild to moderate, noxious, or toxic stimuli, which actually exercise is, for example, is that we're telling our bodies, oh, there's an injury here, it's time to upregulate or make more of the feel-good neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. So it turns out that intentionally inviting hard things into your life is a great way to get dopamine without going into a dopamine deficit state. Obviously, you don't want to overdo it. Mm-hmm. It is possible to get addicted to pain, but in general, this is a very good strategy.
Dr. Lemke, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to the callers.
That's Dr. Anna Lemke, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. She talked to us about her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. It came out in paperback this month. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.